The Bible reading this morning is taken from Mark 16, verses 1 to 8. And it's found in the Black Pew Bibles, page 1010. This particular chapter is the resurrection and those wonderful words that we've said today. Jesus has risen. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb, and they asked each other, "Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?" But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "You were looking for Jesus, the Nazarene, who was crucified. He has risen. He's not here. See the place where they laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. Here ends the reading.
Good morning, St. Paul's. Good to see you this Easter Sunday. Great to have you here in church. If you're new or visiting with us today, great to have you here. My name's Keith. I'm one of the ministers here. And this is, as Ken said, the greatest day of the Christian year as we celebrate the resurrection of Jesus. Now, you want to choose very carefully where you stand. You want to choose very carefully where you stand, and experience teaches you this. So tomorrow, our family's off to the Easter show, and at the Easter show, I'm expecting we're going to be visiting a lot of the animal stalls, and the animals at the Easter show tend to be very well fed. And of course, the saying is, what goes in must come out, and so you have to be very careful where you stand when you go to the Easter show. But sometimes there's more at stake than just a mishap. I remember when I was young, around 10, 11, 12, I used to love climbing trees. It was kind of an obsession of mine. And a mate and I were very good at it. We were a very good team. And we decided that we were going to conquer all the tallest trees around our neighbourhood. Didn't matter where they were, other people's yards, whatever. One of the tallest trees was actually in the courtyard of the high school. And they wouldn't let you climb that during high school hours. And so we worked out a way to get into the high school after hours so that we could climb this tree. Really, that's all we were doing, honestly, officer. That is all we were doing. And I remember we got a long way up. It was about two-thirds of the way up this tree, well above all of the buildings, which were two-story. And I put my foot on a branch that looked kind of solid, looks quite thick and looks solid. But as I put my foot on it, I realized that the branch was actually dead. And the whole thing snapped under my weight. And right there and then, my short life flashed before my eyes. I managed to grab the branch and quickly find another foothold, so I didn't go plummeting several stories down to the ground. But it just reminded me, you want to choose very carefully where you stand. It's not just our actual feet, our physical feet, our physical standing that's important. We make a stand with our lives. We make a stand with our lives when we choose what is worth trusting to be the bedrock for all of our decisions and all of our thinking about our lives. When we say, when my back is to the wall, when it gets really tough, this is the thing that I'll never give up. That's where we're making a stand. And you see it all sorts of places. You see it in a story like Les Mis. I don't know whether you've seen the movie of Les Mis or seen the musical before, but of course there's that powerful scene where the young men in the second act. The young men, they decide they're going to make their stand on the ideal of revolution and of freedom. And of course, their young blood fills the gutters of those streets. But it's not just in stories, you see it in real life as well. Last week, I heard a story on ABC Radio about a church in Indonesia that is in a predominantly Muslim city. And this church had been growing, and it had got to the point where it had outgrown its present facilities, and so it had raised the money and it was building extensions onto the building to accommodate all the people. And the people around didn't like that very much. And governments were petitioned and people rose up. And the radio report was there live and captured the sounds and the squealing and the hysteria of the people who belonged to the church as they watched a bulldozer go through the middle of that building, not only knocking down the extension work, but the rest of the building as well, and raising it to rubble on the ground. The pastor said on radio, "We will rebuild this church every time they knock it over. It doesn't matter how many times they knock it over, we will raise it again so that we can worship Jesus." They made their stand on Jesus. On what do you stand? What is the bedrock that you have chosen to build your life on? What is it that you think is the one thing that won't move when all else is bashed by the waves of history? Today is Easter Sunday. And today, literally, billions of people will gather to declare that Jesus is worth trusting with your life. And that may seem puzzling at one level. You may have seen a banner outside our church or seen signs somewhere or heard something we're advertising today is about the victorious king. And that seems a strange thing to say after hearing that reading from the Bible that we just heard read. We've been working our way through Mark's gospel, Mark's biography of Jesus as a church over this last term. And as you read through Mark, you see some incredible things about Jesus. You see how Jesus reveals what God is like, who God is. You see what an unexpected God the real God actually is. And it's a grand story that Mark paints of Jesus' life. But it's amazing that this grand story, so beautifully crafted together by Mark, should end in the way that it ends, in the way that we just heard read. Some women who were close to Jesus, running away from a tomb, terrified and choosing not to speak about it. And you think, really, Mark? That's the way you want to end? That's how this whole thing ends? How does this point us to a victorious king? How could Jesus be someone worth making a stand on based on what you read in those eight verses that close Mark's gospel? Well, the scriptures give us five lines of evidence that all weave together, that combine to make a strong testimony to the historicity, the realness of the resurrection of Jesus on that first Easter Sunday. And those five lines of evidence can be summed up with the acronym FEET. And with these feet, you make your stand, you see. Now, Mark, in those eight verses, has four of these five strands of evidence. So let me show them to you. Firstly, F, fatal torment. Jesus really died. So throughout the years, some people have suggested that Easter Sunday is actually a fraud because Jesus didn't really die on the cross. He just appeared to die, and those who took him and put him in the tomb didn't realize that he'd actually just passed out. And once he had been in a cold tomb for a few days, he gained enough strength in and of himself, and so he got up and walked out of the tomb all on his own. Some people have suggested that throughout the years. The problem with that theory is that there's just too much evidence to the contrary, like there is in the first verse of Mark chapter 16. If you don't have it open, there's a Bible in the seats in front of you, and it'd be great if you turn open Mark chapter 16. I don't want you to take my word for this. I want you to see that what I'm talking about is right there in the Bible. So Mark 16, verse 1. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Now the women here, they want to go and pay devotion to Jesus. So they were there when Jesus died on the cross. They had followed Jesus for many years. They wanted to pay devotion, as was typical in the Jewish kind of celebration or recognition at the end of a life, and particularly of Jesus, a rabbi, one whom they've grown so close of. But their time of devotion at his point of death was cut short because it was Friday, and sundown Friday was the beginning of the Sabbath, where you weren't allowed to have anything to do, any association with the dead at all. You'd become unclean. And so the women had to wait for the Sabbath, that is sundown Friday through to the end of sundown Saturday, to be able to plan to go back to the body. When the Sabbath's over, sundown Saturday, they go and buy some spices. Now, why did they do that? They did that because they were planning to go the first opportunity, first light, Sunday morning, to go and pay devotion to Jesus, who had been dead since Friday, and they're expecting him to start to smell. So they're buying spices to kind of perfume Jesus' body so they can spend some time with the body paying devotion to him. The point is, they expect him to smell. He's dead. They recognize that he was dead. Later in verse 6, the angel announces, "You're looking for Jesus, the Nazarene, who was crucified." Now it's significant that we get it pointed out to us that Jesus was crucified. We're used to hearing that, crucified, now in association with Jesus, and we can kind of wash over that detail. But crucifixion was the Romans' choice of putting to death of those who were slaves, of those who were prisoners of war, and those who were criminals against the state of Rome. Some 30, 40 years earlier, when the pirates were dominating the Mediterranean Sea around Rome and interrupting the trade, Julius Caesar had his navy capture the pirates, and they crucified all of them, thousands of them, up and down the Appian Way, the main road leading into Rome, crosses all the way down the side of the road. Because crucifixion was the way to get maximum pain for those whom you're punishing, and maximum spectacle for those who would see the crosses and think Rome is so mighty. And the Romans were very good at their job. They're very good at crucifying people. They knew how to kill people by doing that. And so when we hear Jesus was crucified, it is a statement that he was truly dead. This is the first strand of evidence for Jesus' resurrection. He truly died. Fatal torment. Secondly, the expectations of resurrection. We become so used to hearing about Jesus and a resurrection that you could be mistaken in thinking that wasn't an unusual thing to have happened, that was an easily in people's expectations. But that's not the case. We know that there are two major schools of thought around Jesus' day about resurrections. The Greco-Roman way of thinking about the end of life was that there would be no resurrection because the body was a cage for the soul. The body was a prison that you wanted to get rid of, that you would shed off when you died, and your soul would be released to have this disembodied existence. And so the Greeks and Romans didn't think that there would be a resurrection at all. Standing in contrast to that point of view was the Jewish way of thinking. And they thought there would be a resurrection, but it would be everybody at the final day. When God called the whole thing to a halt, the final day, the judgment day, everybody would rise at the same time to the judgment of God. So the two schools of thought were either no one's going to rise from the dead or everybody's going to rise from the dead. Nobody thought that one man rising from the dead was in the realms of possibility. It was just simply on nobody's radar. Which explains what we read in Mark 16, verse 2. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb and they asked each other, "Who will roll the stone away from the entrance to the tomb?" The women are asking themselves this as they travel to the tomb because there's no men with them. All the male disciples, they're not there. They've gone into hiding. They've chickened off. They're in some room somewhere fearing for their life. Now that's fascinating, remembering that Jesus had predicted his death and his resurrection three times in Mark's gospel up to this point. Three times he said he would rise again from the dead on the third day. And yet none of those disciples had gone to the tomb themselves. Not one of them had thought, nah, Jesus said he would rise again on the third day. Today is the third day after he died. Maybe he'd be rising. Maybe I should go and check it out for myself. None of them thought that, because a single man rising was just not on their radar. They didn't get it at all when Jesus predicted his resurrection. And the women, neither did the women, which is why they were terrified and amazed. And that means that it's extremely unlikely, you see, that this story is being made up. This eventuality just wasn't in people's minds at all. Fatal torment expectations. Thirdly, the empty tomb. The empty tomb stands as a silent historical witness throughout the years that something happened to Jesus. It is a piece of evidence that no historian, whether religious or secular, denies. Nobody denies that there was an empty tomb. Something happened because the body wasn't there. Now, what could that be? Did Jesus get up and walk out of the tomb on his own? We've already seen. No. When they crucified people, people were dead. They really were dead. So that can't be the explanation. Did the women, the people who just went to the tomb, did they go to the wrong tomb? The real tomb over here is here with Jesus, but they went to a different tomb, a tomb that was empty. Is that what could have happened? Well, again, extremely unlikely, because Mark mentions these women who were there when Jesus died. He mentions them by name. They were there when Jesus was buried. He mentions them by name. They saw the tomb that he was put into, and now here he mentions them by name for the third time. They go back to the tomb where they saw Jesus' body was buried. So that's not likely either. Maybe, some people say, the disciples stole the body. They wanted to give people the idea that Jesus had risen from the dead. But again, when you see what the expectations were about resurrections, that's incredibly unlikely as well. It just wouldn't have occurred to them to get a story where one man rises from the dead. Nobody's expecting that. No, the explanation for the empty tomb is given to us by no less an authority than a divine messenger. Mark 16, verse 4. When they looked up, this is the women, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. Don't be alarmed, he said. You are looking for Jesus, the Nazarene, who was crucified. He's risen. He's not here. See the place where they laid him. The tomb was empty because Jesus had risen. Fatal torment, expectations, the empty tomb. Now, the fourth strand of evidence is appearances, the appearances of the risen Jesus. And Mark doesn't talk about these directly, although he does point forward to Jesus' appearances to his disciples in Galilee. In verse 7, the angels tells the women, but go, tell his disciples and Peter, he, that is Jesus, is going ahead of you into Galilee, and there you will see him, just as he told you. When you get to the other Gospels, the Gospels of Matthew, the Gospel of Luke and John, and you get to a letter like 1 Corinthians in the New Testament of our Bibles, you see multiple appearances of the risen Lord Jesus, both to those who were closest to him. And then in 1 Corinthians 15, we're told he appeared to a group of 500 of the closest of the early disciples at one time. Now, some people have said, well, those people, they thought they saw Jesus, but actually they were just so distraught that they'd pinned all their hopes on Jesus as being the Messiah, this great deliverer of their nations. And now their hopes had been dashed. They were so distraught, they couldn't let him go. And so they hallucinated to see him alive. Some people say that. And interestingly, the historian Paul Barnett points out that, you know, two people sleeping in the same bed don't have the same dream. They don't have the same vision. How unlikely is it for 500 people to have the same hallucination at the same time? It's a bigger leap of faith to believe that than it is to believe that actually what they saw was the risen Lord Jesus. Fatal torment, expectations, empty tomb, appearances, and finally, our T is for transformation. The transformation of the first disciples. You see, if I were making up a story about Jesus rising from the dead, and if I were writing it down to try and convince people that it was true, if I were making it up, there are certain things that I wouldn't do. Firstly, I wouldn't list women as the first people to discover the empty tomb. Now, just give me a minute, ladies. I'll try and explain why that is, okay? No disrespect. In Jesus' day, particularly under Jewish law, women were not allowed to appear as witnesses in a court of law because their testimony was thought to be unstable. I'm saying this is back a long time ago. I'm not saying I think this now, okay? You understand. I'm saying historically that was the case. So if you were making up a story and you want to have the most credible witnesses as the first one to discover the empty tomb, you wouldn't put women in there. You'd put Peter, the kind of ace, gun, number one apostle. He'd be the first one. Or you'd put some of the other guys. The reason that the women were there, which caused the early church great embarrassment when all the critics pointed out, you really have women as your first witnesses? How could we believe that? They said, well, that's the way it happened. So we have to write that down. The second thing I wouldn't do is to have those same women, I wouldn't end my story about Jesus with those same women running away in fear and unable to speak about the things that they'd seen. See how Mark ends at verse 8? Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. Okay, what an embarrassing thing for the early church as they have these gospels with which they're trying to persuade the world about Jesus and who he is. The story ends with people running away scared, not saying anything. I wouldn't have written it that way. But the reason it is written that way is because that's the way it happened. And what that tells us is that those first disciples and followers of Jesus were terrified after his death. The women were terrified. The men, they weren't even at the tomb because they were so scared. They were in a room locked away somewhere. The Romans had killed Jesus as an insurrectionist. And now they thought the Romans were going to come after them because they supported Jesus. They were scared. They were locked away. But something happened. Because in a matter of days, those terrified, cowardly disciples had changed. And they went out into the world proclaiming that this Jesus who had died was now risen from the dead. And they proclaimed it without fear before the Jewish authorities who had had Jesus put to death. They proclaimed it without fear before the Romans who were involved with putting Jesus to death. Most of those first disciples, the closest band around Jesus, met their deaths because of the message that they preached that Jesus had died and was now risen again. Now, people might be prepared to go to their death for something they believe is the truth, but they don't go to their death protecting a lie, particularly the horrific way that a lot of those first disciples died. And something else had to account for the transformation of those first followers from fearful to boldly proclaiming that he had risen from the dead. And that something is that he did. And so Mark's ending to his gospel gives us this strong evidence. 4 out of 5 of the strands that point to the historicity of Jesus' resurrection. And so then the question is, well, so what? So what if Jesus rose again? Why would you take your stand on Jesus just because he rose from the dead? What difference does it really make that Jesus rose from the dead? Well, the answer to that question comes from seeing how the resurrection of Jesus fits into the whole picture of who he was and what he came to do. That's what Mark has been trying to lay out for us as he writes his 16 chapters of his biography. That's what we've been looking at as a church, as we've walked through Mark's gospel this term. The resurrection of Jesus underlines everything that Mark has told us about Jesus. The resurrection of Jesus shows that he is the King of the ages, that he is God come to earth, as Malachi and Isaiah prophesied those hundreds of years before, that he is the Son of God, that he came to fulfill the role of servant of the Lord, to suffer and die to release us from sins, as Isaiah said in chapter 53. Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life an offering to sin, that's Good Friday, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. That's Easter Sunday. After he has suffered, that's Good Friday, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. That's Easter Sunday. And by his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, will make many right with God, and he will bear their iniquities, their sins. His resurrection show he is God walked among us to feel our joy, to feel our pain, to relate to us and everything that we're going through. Do you know him? Do you know him? His resurrection shows that he's king of your problems. His resurrection confirms that your biggest problem is sin. Because while Jesus healed the sick and the blind and the lame and the mute and the crippled and the bleeding, his primary mission was not to heal. Otherwise, he would have stayed and healed and healed and healed and healed. But no, his mission was to make a future where healing is not necessary. His mission was to open the gates of the kingdom of heaven to a future where there is no more weeping, where there is no more suffering, where there is no more need for doctors and Medicare and hospitals. And to do that, to achieve that mission, he had to die for our sin. And that means whatever you're facing, sin is your biggest problem. And only Jesus can give the remedy for that problem. And his resurrection shows that his death is the balm that we need. Have you accepted that? Have you accepted that remedy? His resurrection shows that he's the king of the harvest. Jesus said that God's kingdom would start very small like a mustard seed and would grow to be very large like a bountiful crop on a farm. And when that crop had grown to the right time, there would be a harvest. And his resurrection demonstrates that it's his life and his work that is the seed. It is his sinless life, his death for sins and his resurrection that is the seed of the kingdom of God. And 2 billion people across the planet today worshiping the risen Jesus, they currently stand as the fruit of that one seed. And so that means we are living in the days before the harvest. That means that time is not endless. Time is not meaningless. It's all heading to an end. It's all heading to the day of harvest in God's good timing. Are you ready for that day? Are you ready for that day? His resurrection shows that he's the king over the enemy. That though there are spiritual forces in this world that are arrayed against God and against us, that those forces have been defeated. See, Satan's plan was to get rid of Jesus. That's why we read in Luke 22 that Satan enters into Judas to make sure that the betrayal happens, to make sure that the arrest happens, to make sure that the mock trial happens, to make sure that the cross happens. But in the resurrection, Satan is crushed. The strong man has been bound. That's why he's not even mentioned in the last chapters of Mark, because he's a bound force. Have you taken hold of the freedom from the fear of evil that Jesus has provided you? Have you taken hold of that? His resurrection shows that he's king of your days. Time feels to us like a precious resource that just drips through our fingers. Every day we look at the mirror and we see one more day gone. Well, maybe you don't, but I do. One more day gone. Another day that I can't get back. And it feels that way because of death. Because death is the great full stop to every human life. And so we count up everything before that. And the closer we get to the full stop, the more fearful we fear. What's going to happen to us? Who am I in the face of that? But the resurrection shows that someone has taken on death and won. Someone has faced death fair in the face and come through the other side. The grave could not hold him. Our greatest enemy has been defeated. The great full stop of death has been turned into a mere comma in the story of our lives. And so we will never see time in the same way again. Have you grabbed hold of that perspective for your life? The release from the fear of death. His resurrection shows that he is king of your agenda, that when he predicted he would suffer and die and rise again, he had the authority to do just that. And when he declared he would come back in his Father's glory with the angels, he really will do that. And so that when he calls on us, if we want to save our lives, he says, if you want to save your life, you've got to lose it for me. That's the only way you will save it. When he says, give up your identity, give up building a name for yourself and instead find yourself in me. And that's the one true way to truly save your life. When he says that, when he makes that call upon us, he really means it. And so have you given your agenda over to him? Your hopes, your dreams, your plans, have you given it over to him? His resurrection shows that he is the servant king. That though he had armies of angels at his command, he stayed silent as he walked to the cross. That though he could still the waves and raise the dead, he laid down that power to save you and me. He who flung stars into space to cruel nails surrendered with you on his mind. And so the true path to greatness lies not in getting power over others, but in giving it over to serve others. For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Are you living a humble life of service like our Messiah? His resurrection shows that though he was forsaken on that first Good Friday, though he cried that terrible cry, my God, why have you forsaken me? That bitter cup of God's wrath was drained so that grace might pour forth for you and for me. He drank that cup to death. 'Tis mystery all, the immortal dies. An unexpected God indeed. But he is dead no longer. He is alive. And he is the king, he is the victorious king who has defeated sin, who has defeated death, who has defeated the devil, all the forces that array against us to prevent us from knowing life with our Creator. He's defeated them all. He is the victorious King. He is the King of Kings. So where will you stand? Where will you stand? With the hymn writer, I say, on Christ, the solid rock, I stand. All other ground is sinking sand. He is risen. He is risen indeed.